is Vice President of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation. He started studying electricity at the age of 6, became a licensed radio engineer at the age of 15. He has studied the work of Nikola Tesla, Charles Steinmetz, and other electrical pioneers. He's the author of 5 books on electric theory and developed a new mathematics to describe the behavior of electric waves. Would you please welcome Eric Dollard as he presents Dimensional Representation of Electric Waves.
There exists a question as to what electricity is and why it is of importance to understand this phenomenon. Electricity in general can be regarded as the interrelationship between the ethereal and the physical aspects of the universe. Thus, the importance of the study of electricity is the promotion of a better understanding of the non-physical aspects of the universe, these aspects being ignored by the modernism of today, particularly the modern physics. It was shown by Dr. Tesla that proper geometric configuring of the complementary inductions, dielectricity and magnetism, that the conventional laws of electricity start to lose their meaning. Thus, if the science of electricity is to play an important role in the study of the non-physical or the ethereal form, the works of Tesla will provide important information for this study. The information provided by the so-called Tesla experts of today provides little of the necessary material required, since these experts are laboring under the very delusive theories which Tesla stated were inimical to the proper understanding of his discoveries. The degradation of Tesla's name by its association with dredged-up material ranging from Venusian spaceships to the fear of communism must indeed have Tesla rolling over in his grave at 3,600 RPM. In order to facilitate the cleanup of this mess, I will present a demonstration not seen by the public since it was given by Tesla himself almost 100 years ago. After this, a concrete wave theory will be given based on real-world concepts. So to start with here, we have a power supply which produces dielectric induction, or what would be called electrostatic induction by many. It's an old medical Tesla coil from around the turn of the century. Was used for many things, but diathermy, diarsenovinyl coils, and cauterization, and who knows what they cooked up with this thing. In all probability, this apparatus has cured quite a few cases of cancer and whatever through Lukoski methods. We found this in the attic of Borderland when Tom and I took over, and it's provided to be like a gold mine find for this kind of work. The basic diagram is up on the board here of what I'm going to demonstrate. The transparency shows the basic hookup of the transmitter. We have the source of induction which charges the primary capacitor, and then we have two type 1B22 hydrogen spark gaps that were used in the old Western electric radars just after World War II. These provide what's called negative resistance, which accelerates the rate of discharge of the capacitor into a coil and tends to maintain the oscillations for a more extended period of time. Then we have the primary magnetizing coil, which excites the oscillating coil. Now, the output of this device is the terminal that's normally considered the ground, and the high voltage part, which is more rightly called the termination, is what you would call the virtual ground, or grounding into extra dimensional or counter space, which we'll get into a little later. In its physical form, we tilt this up here so people can see it. You can see the capacitor hanging out down here. Just served faithfully since 1928 to 1975 for RCA and still going strong, made by Faradon Incorporated. We have the oscillating coil here with distributed constants of magnetic and dielectric induction, and the magnetizing coil going around the outside. You'll notice a kind of peculiar arrangement of leads here. All these wires are hooked in parallel to minimize the inductance, so most of the magnetism stays in the area where we want it and doesn't end up getting caught up inside the space between the wires here. These so-called conducting materials are all Teflon insulated coax. Because of the skin effect, you don't need any metal on the inside. You're dealing strictly with circumference and no longer with mass of conductors with these type of frequencies. And the advantage of using the Teflon is twofold. It doesn't get destroyed by corona or flashovers, and they have to silver the conductor material before they can put the Teflon on, so it makes it a most perfect reflector for electromagnetic energy. Okay, we're going to start off here by energizing the power supply and going along with this diagram up here on the chalkboard, which is a very conventional electric circuit. And I have a plug here, which will allow me to disconnect this electrical circuit. I'm going to warm up the machine here. Okay. As you can see, the light bulb lights up, as to be expected, when the electrical circuit is energized. But now we'll see something quite interesting, and I guess I'm not going to be able to talk while this is running. You notice when the plug is pulled, the light bulb still lights up. Now, this is a little different than what we were taught in school. Of course, many things are different than what we were taught in school. So what we'll do here is we'll exaggerate this effect by hooking it to this fluorescent lamp, which just ends in free space. But the molecules of the gas embody what's called counter space, a most appropriate conductor for these type of energies. As you can see, it's quite charged, and of course, even more so right there. You know, what we'll do is we'll transmit this energy. We'll take the light bulb out of the circuit here so we don't waste our power. Transfer to the receiving coil. And then we'll draw energy off of the receiving coil. So here we have Tesla's single wire power transmission. We have one conducting path. Tesla found, because of the skin effect of so-called conductors, which are far from conductors, as Heaviside pointed out, they're best called obstructors. As Wilhelm Reich points out, that they're best called reflectors. And of course, the back of any microwave dish indicates that. So what we have to use as a medium for transmitting these longitudinal waves is a gas, which acts as a series of capacitors and has a very difficult time generating a magnetic field with which to oppose the flow of electric energy. And we can come up with some other things here. Now what we can do to demonstrate this is, of course, now if you do this normally, the light bulb will go out, and if it's a constant current system, usually it makes a very big spark. Quickly to stay across. The light bulb still wants to stay. Let somebody can hit the lights for just a second. Even though it has a wire right across it. Now, what's interesting, you know, I don't want to take the time to do it here, but I did this before in the laboratory before I brought this stuff here, is you can start wrapping the lamp with copper wire to make sure that there's no flux leakage to account for the fact the gas is lighting up. But the tube will still light up. What Tesla found is you can enclose this in a complete copper sleeve and put a little slot in it, and it still lights up inside. He's able to take hollow metal balls, or basically glass with metal deposited on the outside, and the light inside would be so bright that you could perceive it right through the metal coating on the glass. Tesla indicates this in his lectures where he was doing the very same thing here. Now, of course, his apparatus were a little more sophisticated. As you see, these things are made out of old yardsticks and barrel hoops and things, you know, we found at the junkyard. So this is basically all that's happening here with this, then. It's a pretty clear demonstration that you don't need two wires to transmit electricity. And if you scale these things up, then the Earth itself becomes the single conductor. And no real conducting or inducting medium is required anymore. The Earth itself will do that. And that's what Tesla was attempting at Colorado Springs. With vacuum tube excitation on these units, so you can get, you know, something with some RMS oomph to it, you actually can pump several amperes of current into the ground, but it doesn't draw any energy from the power supply. It still remains totally resonant. The only energy consumed is that to overcome the losses of the vacuum tubes and other things. There's one more thing I wanted to demonstrate here. Connect back up the other way. This will be good enough. Put this light bulb back in the circuit. Okay, now this is a 110-volt light bulb. I won't bother to pass it around to prove it. It could be no more than 220. But at any rate, find a better clip here. Okay, I guess if we can turn the lights out for a second again. I think it might be kind of hard for people to see, but there's a spark I get across the light bulb of 1,000 volts. But it's only a 110-volt light bulb. Now, what's happening here is very interesting with this light bulb, is if you compare the spectrum of this bulb, which is a regular bulb, to a bulb just like it operating in a regular 60-cycle power circuit, you'll find that this thing's putting out near a full spectrum. Where on the 60 cycles, all you get is the orange-red. Now, something that's even more interesting, and I suppose some people can come up and try to feel it. There's a pressure being thrown out of this bulb, and you can feel a mechanical pressure pushing your fingers out. Of course, regular light bulb circuits don't do that, but this is a regular light bulb. So it's interesting that just a conventional apparatus, when run on a new type of electricity, will produce new types of phenomenon. Okay, what I'm going to try to get into now, without confusing the hell out of everybody, is how all this works. So we'll start off, let's see here, the best way to begin. Oh, I guess we have to transfer our audio lines. Am I still okay? Yeah, that's the problem with this kind of work, is just you can't use conventional instruments, you can't use videotape recorders to record these things when they're operating at their full power level. It's kind of like electrons just don't want to work around this stuff, which kind of makes you wonder why they tell you electrons carry electricity, because they don't work when you use real electricity. By the way, the article I wrote for the New Journal of Borderland, I discuss these situations basically and point out what's really happening with the conductors, which I felt was necessary because the buzzword now in everybody's mouth is superconductors. So many people asked me about superconductors that it finally made me mad, and I had to write an article describing what was going on, that they're not conductors, that they're really obstructors, and I show how this works. It'll be as part of a series of articles. The next one will be the dielectric hysteresis of the ether, which I'm sure many engineers will find quite fascinating, and I'll show the experimental setup for measuring the hysteresis of the ether. Ready? Okay. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, let's see. Well, I have those already then. Okay, these are our basic equations we're going to work with here. Okay, so what we're going to deal with now is the dimensions of electrical quantities, which is basically bringing electricity down the earth into centimeters and seconds and grams and things we're more familiar with dealing with. And we're going to try to develop a new set of dimensions that are more in tune with how electricity behaves than the mechanical dimensions that we presently use to describe electrical phenomena. But much of this material I'm presenting right here in the beginning I'm going to have to read, because these are quotes from J.J. Thompson and a fellow by the name of Atwood, the two of which were proposing specific dimensional units to be used in electrical engineering. The electric quantities encountered in working with the phenomenon of electricity are specified quantitatively in terms of units that have been jointly agreed upon by various international committees on electrotechnology. These quantities may be alternately expressed in terms of a number of units, five being chosen by convention, and thus a form of system of units. Quantities so defined will in general be expressed in two more fundamental units, or said to have the dimensions of these units. The system of units, as utilized by electrical workers of today, possess exceedingly disadvantageous conditions that render a clear concept of electricity next to impossible. The foremost of these conditions is the use of mass for defining electrical quantities. This works significant harm into the proper understanding of electricity, since in general the phenomenon of electricity is mass-free. The present system of units is subdivided into a pair of subsystems of units, these being the subsystem of electromagnetic units and the subsystem of the electrostatic units. The electromagnetic units do not coincide with the electrostatic units. The electromagnetic subsystem bears to the electrostatic subsystem, excuse me, a definite ratio which is connected with the units of length and the units of time. In the CGS system of units, the electromagnetic unit is found to be C squared times larger than the electrostatic units, where C is the velocity of light. The result of this disproportion is to distort the understanding of the relation between magnetism and its conjugate, dielectricity. The units of magnetism have such predominance over the units of electricity, since C is such a large number, that the dielectricity is obscured from view. As an example, between a pair of wires, the mechanical force developed by one ampere, a unit of magnetism, is far greater than the mechanical force developed by the volt, a unit of dielectricity. Hence, the unit of the volt is far too small, where 100 kilovolts is much more in balance with one ampere and would be better taken as a unit of dielectricity. It may be seen that the dimensions of the electric quantities are in general a matter of definition and depend upon the form of the system of units which are adopted. The adoption of a specific system of units in the establishment of a results in the establishment of a perspective limited by the system chosen. That is, what appears to be true in one system may have no meaning in another system. For example, a quantity of water may be fixed by the number of hydrogen atoms it contains, by its mass, or by its volume at a specific temperature. All these measures would be of different dimensions. It is therefore preferable to adopt a system of units which allows for the proper perspective with regard to the phenomena being engineered. The specific aim of this paper to present a system of units that is useful for the representation of the phenomena discovered by the great electrical pioneers such as Faraday and Tesla. This system of units must also retain enough of the system which has become conventional so as to serve as a basis for the description of electrical phenomena in present use. Okay, mechanical quantities such as force, power, and energy can be expressed in not more than three fundamental units. These units are ordinarily being chosen and approved by the International Committee on Weights and Measures for Mechanical Relations are 1. Length, 2. Time, and 3. Mass. As an example, force is the product of mass and acceleration, or mass multiplied by length divided by the square of time. The convenient dimensional formula being force equal to mass to the first power, length to the first power, and time to the minus second power. Extension of this mechanical system of units to include electric quantities requires a fourth unit. For this, the ICWM has chosen mu sub O, the magnetic permeability of free space. But any other electric quantity, for instance, the volt, ampere, ohm, etc., may be chosen. The choice for one particular unit determines the size of all the other units. For the development of another system of units, it's more satisfactory to adopt the unit of dielectric inductions, I, as the fourth dimensional unit. The dimensional formula for electric quantities then takes on the form where any quantity equals mass to the A power, length to the B power, time to the C power, and psi to the D power, with A, B, C, and D each assuming an integral value of plus or minus quantity. By the basic physical energies entering to the particular quantity, by the use of dielectric induction rather than the magnetic permeability for the new system of units, a ratio appears between the new system and the standard system. This ratio is connected with the units of length. The new system is found to be length times the existing units, and of course in CGS this would be centimeters. To complete this new system of units, it is desirable to eliminate the dimensional unit of mass. This is best accomplished by replacing it with the unit of magnetic induction, and for reference, defining magnetic induction as a quantity that equals mass to the first power, length to the second power, time to the minus one power, and charge to the minus one power. Hence, this new system of units embodies the four fundamental dimensional units of electricity: time, space, magnetism, and dielectricity. Each of these is fundamental, and thus the concept of any three-dimensional or four-dimensional space or etc. is entirely erroneous, since there exists but one dimension of space. Now, here is one of the biggest flaws in our present understanding of electricity. We take the corner of a cube to be representative of volume of space, and say, therefore, we have a space of three dimensions. We only have one dimension of space, that's space. And if we want to deal with volume of space, the way we have to deal with is the sphere, not side of a cube. Now this is what's worked into the understanding of electricity. Our picture of electricity is the corner of a cube. And basically, apparatus we build, such as computers and all these things, are based on these kind of relationships. And this right-angle crossing type of phenomena has even pervaded modern architecture until now all the buildings look like folded-up pieces of graph paper. And if you don't see an XY coordinate system on any TV commercial, there must be something wrong with it. So obviously there's an archetypal or fundamental flaw in our method of thinking and representation of geometry that has completely precluded any possibility of understanding the other aspects of electricity. The dimensional unit of space and time may be represented in different forms, however, such as plus time being direct time, minus time being reverse time. Or in other words, we multiply time by positive 1 if we want to indicate it going forwards, and we multiply time by minus 1 if we want to indicate it going backwards, but we only have one dimension of time. Then we have a peculiar phenomenon known as frequency, which is the square root of the quantity 1 over time squared. Now, as soon as you square root a square quantity, that indicates immediately that it's a complex quantity consisting of real and imaginary parts. This is something that's little understood. The most general frequency is not given in radians per second or cycles per second. The most general frequency is given in meter radians per second or decibel cycles per second. And this is something that's not generally understood, but these are the waves produced by Tesla's apparatus. They not only have circular function or angular velocities, they have hyperbolic functions or exponential velocities. Now for space, space is a little different. Space works where direct space is a quantity raised to the plus one power, but there's another type of space, counter space, that's space raised to the minus one power. So if we want to measure direct space, we measure it in centimeters. If we want to measure counter space, we measure it in per centimeters. Since by definition, the phenomenon of electricity is the complex product of magnetism phi and dielectricity psi, which is indicated by equation one here, a system of dimensional units in general need but consist of three fundamental dimensional units, as was the case with mechanical units. So we have the unit lowercase psi, or phi, which is the unit of electric induction, and according to the quantum mechanical model of reality, it's called Planck's constant, or any multiple thereof. But this doesn't necessarily have to be the case. This quantity is a scalar quantity existing throughout all of space and time. Okay, then we have a metrical unit, or dimension, the dimension of time, and a metrical unit, the dimension of space. These three things making up the dimensions of electricity. The pair of dimensional formula that arise from these three fundamental dimensional units are thus the power P in watts and a new quantity. This not be to be confused with what's called the charge of an electrical system. I just use the letter Q because it exists in complement to P. So the power P in watts is the square of the rate of the production or consumption of the units of electric induction. The density of electric induction, of course, is the per centimeter squared value of that. Obviously, representation of the... Well, let's see here now. Where am I? Okay, got that. These are signified... The dot here signifies that this is a complex quantity in time consisting of real and imaginary parts. The line here indicates that this is a complex quantity in space consisting of real and imaginary parts. This indicated by the fact that you have a square. Okay, now conventionally, power is given by this. C squared being the velocity of light squared. And of course, we have our names for the stuff over here. This would be joules per second. But now we end up with a little bit of paradox if we try to define the density of electric induction in conventional units, which is grams per second, which makes absolutely no sense. How can a density be defined in grams per second? First of all, the electricity doesn't weigh anything. You can find out by taking two magnets and trying to put them together. You feel a piece of jelly in between the magnets, but it doesn't drop to the floor when you take the magnets away. And C squared ends up having a rather peculiar relationship, which is the ratio of energy to mass, or joules per gram, which is a real funny way to say the velocity of light squared, but somehow that's what we got wrapped up into. Okay, since the total electric induction is the product of the complementary components of induction, the magnetic and dielectric, we can take the time rate of lines consumed or produced per second, which we call electromotive force, or volts, and we can take complementary for the dielectric field lines per second, which produces displacement current, or amperes. Now, this is a true electrical current that doesn't involve the flow of any electrons. This is the current that flows through insulators and will flow through free space without any particular molecular structure to carry it. Okay, if we combine these two things together, then we get what's called the law of electric induction, which, of course, leads us right back to the power P in watts. So the power then comes from the law of electric induction. Okay, for the dimensional representation of electric waves, it is of importance to develop what's called the electric constants of the structure which propagates these waves. It is the nature of these constants, they are independent of the quantity of electricity involved in general in a linear condition and express only the geometric conditions involved. Traditionally, these constants are known as the magnetic inductance L, which is embodied in this equation, and the capacitance or dielectric induction C, which is embodied in this equation. The factor I is called the magnetic potential, again measured in amperes, and the factor E is called the dielectric potential, which is measured in volts. But even though the same units are used conventionally, we find we have two species of volts and two species of amperes, somewhat less than a desirable condition. Let's go to the next sheet and see if that turns out to be the right one. Okay, good. We get to continue here. Okay. Let's see. The coefficients L and C are thus the proportionality factors of the magnetic and dielectric components of the electrical field. So hence, the magnetic inductance is given as the ratio of the amount of magnetism and the amount of magnetic potential behind it. This inductance is functionally equivalent to the area enclosed by the electric geometry. So in other words, the inductance then is functionally equivalent to square centimeters, which can be very easily seen in these coils here because the inductance component of it definitely encloses square centimeters. There's no complication in seeing that. Even though conventionally it's given in centimeters, but that doesn't tie in with physical reality. The specific geometry of the electric conductor material introduces the dimensionless proportionality factor gamma. This factor is a measure of the degree of bounding by the conductors. Thus, the inductance is more appropriately expressed then as centimeters squared divided by a dimensionless quantity reflecting the geometry of the material. And then we have to throw all this garbage on it to make it equal to Henry. And we'll get into how that works a little later. Likewise, the capacitance is the ratio of the total quantity of dielectric induction to the potential required to maintain this induction. This capacitance C is functionally equivalent to the inverse of the square of the velocity of light in the space L squared containing the magnetic inductance. So then capacitance then is second squared per centimeter squared. The same geometric factor gamma as for the magnetic inductance applies to the capacitance but inverse form. And again we have to add the same pile of stuff out here to make it equal to Faraday, the accepted unit. It is found in studying these things that the electric conductor does not conduct, that serves as a converter between dielectricity and magnetism, this taking place through the dimension of time. And this is indicated by the equation here, T squared equals the product of the inductance times the capacitance. The factor 4 pi is a survival of the original definition of the magnetic mass. The magnetic flux of unit mass became 4 pi lines of force and introduced the factor 4 pi into most electric quantities. Attempts to drop this factor have failed, as the units are too well established. So that's why we just put them all off to the side here, so that people that want to stay within the bounds of conventional representation will be able to do that for reference purposes. The factor 10 to the minus 9 defines the CGS units, and the factor rho is given by the ratio of mass to charge squared. But being that the L and C are geometric units, the ratio is superfluous because it doesn't matter how much mass or how much charge there is, because it's a purely geometrical form. So what we'll do is we'll make this equal unit value and forget about it again off to the side, because this is the need of the matter here. Just like with the magnetic inductance, this is what we're dealing with here. The electric circuit constants L and C are only the partial representations of the electric induction, since they're connected with transverse waves only. It is therefore desirable to extend these constants so as to represent the more general electric wave. Okay, I think the next drawing will help us out here. Okay, if we take a pair of electric circuits, let's say the power of running two railway systems or a pair of telephone lines or anything it may be, this representation here is a pair of railway circuits, such as a subway system. Mechanical forces appear which tend to cause attractions and repulsions between the wires of these transmission lines. The forces of repulsions are shown by figure 1. Should be the next figure. Formed by the and it's not a time function, is the ratio of the magnetism to the amount of potential, Henry's per centimeter. And then, of course, the mutual induction is the inverse of that, and the subscripts indicate the directions as shown earlier. This, of course, being a reference for people to use to remember the directions. And if we combine these two together, we get the wave of magnetism. And our dimensions all cancel out except the per centimeters, and we have meters squared per centimeter squared. So basically, if we take the square root of this quantity, that's called our dielectric propagation constant in per centimeters. If we take the square root of this, that gives us our magnetic propagation constant in per centimeters. Okay, the next slide, we'll bring the two together. So if we take the two transverse quantities and multiply them together on a distributed constant or per centimeter basis, we end up with radians squared per centimeter squared, and likewise for the longitudinal, we end up with per radian squared centimeter squared. Now we'll make some substitutions here, going back to our original formulas and working our way down here. We end up with our dimensions of our waves. LC, or the propagation constant of transverse electromagnetism, is the ratio of time to space. And this is typically 1 over C squared. But for the longitudinal magnetodielectric wave, we have a rather peculiar set of dimensions here. Now we have the product of time and space. So if we want to talk about the propagation of a transverse electromagnetic wave, we talk about it in miles per hour. If we want to talk about the propagation of a magnetodielectric wave, we have to speak of it in mile hours, which is a dimension worth considering. Okay, now earlier I showed that time, I didn't show, but we're going to have to assume this as a postulation, that time can only be dealt with as being multiplied by positive 1 or negative 1. So time appearing in the denominator here is basically the result, because we're dealing with this in admittance and we're dealing with this in impedance. So what's happened is our length, or space factor, is the one that's really been inverted. So what we have then is we have propagation in direct space, and we have propagation in counter space, and the combination of these two being the general propagation of electric induction. Okay, now what I'm going to do is we're going to go through, let's see what we got next here. We're going to go through each of these constants a little bit. Just as a review, we have the magnetic inductance. This representing the total inductance, represents the storage of magnetic energy in transverse form by the production of magnetic flux, this being the magnetic flux. The basic dimensions here are centimeters squared, and if we use this for distributed constants, then of course it's just centimeters. Okay, then we have the magnetic inductance, or what we would call 1 over the mutual inductance for those that are typically used to dealing with this quantity as mutual inductance in Henry's. This represents the storage of energy in longitudinal form by the production of magnetic flux. And our equation for magnetic flux becomes a little more complicated here. The dimensions of this are per unit length squared, or in other words, per centimeter squared, and for distributed constants, it's per centimeter cubed. Okay, now we'll go to the dielectric inductions. Okay, we have dielectric capacity, represents the storage of dielectric energy in transverse form by the production of dielectric flux. The dimensions of these are inverse velocity squared, and for distributed constants, it's time squared per centimeter cubed. Okay, we'll go to the next one. Okay, we have our dielectric elastance. This represents the storage of dielectric energy in longitudinal form by the production of dielectric flux. And the dimensions of this are C squared directly and not inverse. And in distributed constants, it gives us centimeters divided by seconds squared. So now we'll combine these. We have our wave of magnetic induction, which has the units of per centimeter squared, which basically indicates for the square of every centimeter you go down the line, you're going to get a specific quantity of variation. And the distribution of dielectric induction, of course, is corresponding. Okay, and we'll go for the electric waves. We have the transverse electromagnetic wave, giving us the dimensions of seconds squared divided by centimeters squared, this being the ratio of time to space. And then the next one, the longitudinal magnetodielectric wave, dimensions being per units of length squared multiplied by per units of time squared, or the product of time and space. Okay, well, we end up with two other very interesting waves here when we combine these. It'll take us a little out of the normal realm. We have the space scalar of longitudinal induction. If we end up crossing these waves, this being done by using what are called caduceus coils. Now these equations, I first came across these when I was starting to use this system to model the works of George Van Tassel, which some of you may be familiar with, his integratron and his work with caduceus coils and his associates' work with the caduceus coils. These waves exist completely outside of the dimension of space. The dimension of space cancels out. We end up with kind of a cockeyed wave factor that appears more of, as a ratio of a product, but we end up with the dimensions of 1 over time squared, which of course we might call frequency by square rooting it, So what we have here is a situation of almost pure alternating current. There's no space function anymore, it's a pure time function. Also, this can be reduced to what's called a series resonance circuit, which of course has no meaning in space because the constants are lumped and there's no per centimeters, and all you get is the time function. This basically being what Tesla started working with, was the series resonance circuit. And then we have the corresponding parallel resonance circuit, which gives us a similar type of dimensionality. Now, how these exactly tie in with caduceus coils is a whole other subject, and I'm not really prepared to get into that right now. That's in an entirely another notebook. So basically, to wrap this up, as we find here, we've got a lot more electric waves than we're normally studying, and it's a dimensionality or a system of describing electricity that allows us to deal with existing waves in their conventional form and describe a new system of waves in concrete realities of seconds and centimeters. So that basically wraps up my talk, and I can answer any questions you have or give some more demonstrations with the coils. Or how much time do I have left? 4 minutes? Worked out perfectly. Are there any questions? Yes.
Would you please comment?
All or none.
I'll ask the question this time. Would you please comment on the experimental results involving spirals and the Kreisphyla noted by Wilhelm Reich in his publication Cosmic Superimposition? What significance do we have here?
Okay, could you just, there's a word I didn't hear.
Well, they're called Kreisphyla or spinning waves.
Oh, spinning waves, okay. Well, the spinning waves, and that's a different type of situation. That doesn't really tie in directly with this, but as far as the effects of cosmic superimposition, when we brought two fields of dielectric induction pulsating very rapidly in time into each other, okay, I wish I actually had slides of my apparatus that I used to do this. We take the two coils, okay, and we have them out of phase with each other. It's a very large push-pull Tesla coil driven by vacuum tube amplifier oscillator system. We take our fluorescent lamp, we wave it between the coils. Now, according to the Faraday theories of lines of force, this thing produces a solenoidal dielectric flux. I'll draw this on the chalkboard here. We have coil A operating on phase A, coil B operating on phase B. This, of course, being one polarity, and this being the other polarity at any instant in time. This, of course, being driven by oscillating and alternating current. One would expect a solenoidal field of dielectric induction to exist around these things, and in space conjunction with the magnetic field, that would also have the same kind of shape. Now, of course, we know if we take our pickup loop connected to an ammeter, which I can show on this thing here. Is it okay to turn this on? I don't think I'll blast anything. I won't be able to talk. See, the meter reads. You can measure magnetism around these things, even though it's not totally easy to do without burning things up sometimes. You find the meter reads the highest in here, along this plane here. But if you take your usual dielectric measuring instrument, which is the fluorescent lamp or the neon bulb, fluorescent lamp being the most interesting, and wave it around, there will be a neutral sheet that appears between these two transformers. Now, when you place a large globe of a primordial medium, ether and plasma, in that space, you find that you get everything that Reich talks about in cosmic superimposition. You get the production of energy, you get the coalescing of these geometric spirals. All of this stuff is specifically built on the golden ratio. So this basically serves as a direct analog, if not, in reality, a cosmic superimposition machine. That's why I call this device that I built, which uses Tesla coils as a component, the cosmic induction generator. Does that answer your question, basically? Okay. Any more questions?
Are you familiar with the mathematics of dual tensor densities?
No, I'm not.
Well, you just got through giving me a course in it. I would appreciate it if you would let me have your work. I'd like to convert it into this.
Okay, my papers are for sale with Clark Kent out there.
Oh, okay.
That's basically how Actually, one thing I would like to point out is the fact is this is all made possible by members of the USPA. That's how this stuff gets built. It was only recently that anyone has provided any no-strings-attached money to cover our expenses.
Exactly.
But I owe most of this to members of the USPA. Of course, the USPA itself is not prepared to give donations, but the members themselves, or you people, are what makes this happen.
Well,
I appreciate that.
Well, if I can it into that mathematics, we may be able to see implications that even you don't see right now. The mathematics is very extensive. It's never been really applied to a physical situation, and I was amazed that that's what I was looking at you and you were talking, you know. So we'll talk about that later.
Okay. Well, basically, the mathematics here, this is stuff I pieced together from the old-timers around the turn of the century. You find that basically a very well-established, solid theory of electricity was presented along with all of its mathematics, but was smothered to death by quantum physics.
Hear, hear. What a compliment to you on developing a system of dimensional analysis. That's something that also gets smothered quite often in freshman physics classes. They spend about a half page on dimensional analysis in most 600-page books. And as a result, a lot of things fall through the cracks, and I'm glad you've dug them out. It's really been great to hear what you've done. What I'd like to ask you about, and something that I didn't understand because it went over pretty quickly, there was a dimension of kilograms per second that was given for some electrical phenomenon or unit or something. I didn't quite get what that was.
Okay, that was the density of electric induction.
Density,
right,
of electric induction.
Electric induction being defined as the product of total magnetic induction, phi, and the total dielectric induction, psi. Which in conventional physics has the dimensions of energy time or joule seconds.
Yeah.
But if you divide everything out,
it comes out kilograms.
Yeah,
per
and take it per square centimeter, or let's say photons per square centimeter to keep in tune with the physics model of it. The dimensions of photons per square centimeter is grams or kilograms or pounds or whatever per second or minute, or in other words, the ratio of mass to the time or the rate of production or consumption of mass.
Okay, now my understanding was that if you took or multiplied or took the product of phi and psi, that gave you the dimensions of Planck's constant, which is...
Okay, E being energy in this case.
Well, just what I meant was you take phi and psi, multiply them together,
right,
and it comes out being units, you know, dimensional analysis units, kilograms, meters squared over seconds.
Right, but now if you take that per square centimeter,
yep,
that gives you kilograms per second.
Okay, I'll have to talk to you about that later. The other thing was, how, you know, when you were talking about propagation velocity of dielectric waves, I didn't think I understood or heard you say how fast that might be in meters per second units. Like if you had an air capacitor, say a centimeter apart, meter area of plates separated by a centimeter, how fast could I expect a dielectric wave when you're, you know, the starting transistor, just as you're charging up that...
That's a good question. I'm still working on that. Steinmetz comes up with a set of equations leaving the propagation velocity of dielectricity and the propagation velocity of magnetism as independent variables. So it's a matter of experimentation to change the frequency to see how many ohms you get to determine this propagation velocity. He uses the words the hysteresis of the ether to describe this velocity effect and shows how that it produces resistances or conductances in the fields themselves in pure vacuum if we're isolating.
But you haven't actually calculated the velocity in meters per second.
No, that's a project I've been working on for a while, but it's very difficult.
Okay, the reason why I brought that up, the meters, the kilograms per second and the velocity, you multiply those two together, you get force. And I think once you come up with that number, velocity of dielectric waves, you've got the answer for Townsend Brown's flying machines.
Okay, one thing I would like to point out is Professor Wheatstone claims that the velocity of propagation of what they called frictional electricity back then, which would be dielectricity, is pi over 2 times the velocity of light. That basically the propagation velocity of the electrostatic field, or what they called frictional electricity at the time, is pi over 2 times the velocity of light. Now this, oddly enough, tidbit of information appeared in a book called Babbitt's Theory of Light and Color, which no one would expect to find any useful information for anything like this. But what you'll find is reading Babbitt's Light and Color, which, by the way, is now being reprinted by Borderland, 99 years since it's been last printed, just like it's been 99 years since this has been demonstrated. Babbitt comes up with a very solid model for Faraday's contiguous particle of the ether and shows how they lock together to produce lines of force.
Eric, you said about a force field or a force around the ball. Would it be possible for people to sample that? Speaking.
Yes.
And the other thing is, what practical benefits society-wide do you see for this work?
I don't look at this stuff practically. I'm a natural philosopher. I think it's best not used practically until it's very well understood.
So you feel it's too immature as
right.
a science.
Now, there is one practical thing, and it's our next experiment scheduled okay. for our next set of projects. And this is relatively safe to use. That may be found, and these are the coils that I'll probably work with unless somebody wants to buy them. They are for sale for a big number. That if we take, let's say I take our transmitting coil here and we'll hook this to a radio transmitter and we'll ground it to the earth. Let's say we'll do this in Los Angeles. And we'll take this coil here and we'll move it to San Francisco and hook it to a shortwave receiver. Okay, now these coils are resonant at 2.2 kilocycles per second, or no, megacycles per second, or 2200 kilocycles per second. Now we may find, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised, that we would see that our field strength meter, our receiver, would bounce right up there, just like it was hooked to a big transmitting tower. But one very interesting thing with these things, being that we're not whacking on the dielectric hysteresis of the ether anymore, trying to shove the energy from the transmitter to the receiver through a system of complete loss, that we're not going to have to put any power into the coils. All you've got to do is just keep them swinging like an LC circuit. I've already demonstrated this to my satisfaction, and we have a videotape that kind of picks it up, but it's very hard to use video cameras around this stuff when it's broadcasting pretty heavy. If 5 or 6 amperes on a thermoamp meter on the ground connection, okay, and the way this was at the Van Tassel Integratron. The ground there is a very effective insulator, so-called insulator, because we have a quartz. So the 5 amperes, we were cranking back up the power company neutral wire and radiating, I'm sure, all too well off all the power lines. But when the power was measured being consumed by the power supply to run the vacuum tubes, it's found that the power consumed, or the energy consumed, was only connected with that lost in the plates of the vacuum tubes. That it took no energy to maintain the 5 amperes, but of course that's understandable because amperes is not in the dimensions of energy. But I would bet, if we didn't do the experiment, that any shortwave radio on the planet would have picked that signal up just like it was hooked to a Sturba array or a rhombic the size of a football field. So this is one of our next experiments, and I encourage other people to try also. We'll be publishing the dimensions of these apparatus here in Borderland before long. Now, it's one thing I like to warn immediately, is you don't want these things to land on certain frequencies if you're in experiments with this. Stay off the marine frequencies. Stay off the frequencies that the military needs for communications. There are frequencies available for this type of research. I would recommend if you're going to try this type of wireless power transmission for radio purposes, don't use it to try to transmit power except for a one-shot deal, because chances are it's going to be very unhealthy for the environment unless it's tuned right. These things have to be studied yet, exactly what goes on. And we're finding, you know, moving patterns appearing around the transformers. It's quite possible that these machines can be used to heal the damage we did to the planet. That's what we should be looking to do with. We don't need to be cranking more horsepower hours into some pump somewhere to yank water out of the ground and leave the salts laying on the ground to make deserts. We've done enough of that. Let's not help the third world do it for us.
I have just one question. How do you take pictures of your experiments? I know you can't do it very well with videotape, but how about just plain old-fashioned movie cameras?
Yeah, movie cameras, regular photography equipment works fine as long as it doesn't have any solid-state controls. Basically, if you try to use a Polaroid camera around this thing, it just spits all the film out.
In other words, any solid thing like transistor diodes?
These are electrical apparatus and not electronic apparatus, and their fields of induction are almost inimical to the phenomena of electronics.
The good old wind-up movie camera would
yeah,
do it.
The old mechanical stuff.
I see.
That's one thing you'll find with Tesla. See, Tesla was very adamant on not using vacuum tubes, and I'm sure he wouldn't like transistors. He always said you got to use rotating spark gaps and that type of stuff, and there's very specific reason for that, because usually the losses are much higher with vacuum tubes and other things, and the waves themselves can tend to interfere with it. Even though I've had fairly good luck with vacuum tubes, when you want to deal with, there's a class of research called commutative transients. And that's something that Tesla did a lot of research into. Now, the very famous, at this point, Bedini apparatus are an attempt at commutative transients. Now, no one's been able to make any real determinations from that because most of the information is not presented clearly or kept secret from fear of forces that I feel don't even exist. But nevertheless, that is a very important area of research. I would not recommend using batteries, capacitors, or solar cells would be a lot better. The batteries, all that's happening in the batteries is you're not getting free energy. It's you've convinced the battery to work as a primary cell as well as a secondary cell, so you consume the battery and get so-called free energy. But there's a basic phrase I use, it's nothing's free in the free world.
Thank you, Eric Dollard. That's all the time we have left. Please stick around for the next speaker.